Well, there's one thing that we all have in common here this morning. Whether you're young, whether you're graying a little bit on top, whether you're male or female, teenager or adult. In fact, what we share in common is so common that when Jesus Christ himself walked the earth for 33 years, he experienced the same thing. You say, now, well, what is it? What could be so common? Temptation. Every person that ever lives in this world experiences temptation. Let me give you a simple definition of temptation. Temptation is the obvious or subtle pull to do wrong. It's the obvious or the subtle pull to do wrong. It's that grabbing that draws you to evil, to wrong. Now, I've entitled this sermon, Temptation, the Friendly Thief. You say, now that's a strange title for temptation, the friendly thief. And yet, in many ways, that's exactly what temptation is. Temptation is friendly because temptation kind of comes up alongside of us, puts his arm around us, and whispers in our ear in a warm and friendly way plans by which we meet needs that we feel like we have inside. Desires, wishes. And temptation comes up and puts his arm around our shoulder and whispers in our ear, I've got a way for you to resolve that. Let me give you an example. Maybe temptation has warmed up to you and whispered in your ear in relationship to that desire you have for a new boat or a new something that you really can't afford to purchase, and whispers in your ear, I've got a way for you to meet that desire. You know, April 15th is coming up. And if you could hide that one line item, that would provide the down payment. Isn't that nice of temptation to do that for you and I? Maybe your need is love. Maybe you feel lonely. Maybe your spouse or your friends are not meeting this deep need in you. And temptation comes up and puts its arm around you and whispers in your ear, you know the person who lives down the street? The person who works in your office? They seem to be the kind of person that could meet that longing inside. And they seem willing. Well, thank you, temptation, for presenting that opportunity to me. Maybe you have an anger that's boiling inside of you and you feel this strong need to get even. And temptation comes up and puts its arm around you and whispers in your ear, you know, if you shared that secret about Susie with several people, that would really get her. Wouldn't that meet that gnawing inside? You know, in many ways, temptation is friendly. But more than being friendly, it's a thief. Because ultimately, temptation steals from every person. Sometimes it steals our family. Sometimes it steals friendships. But always, always, it steals our character. It steals the good inside of us and directs us to wrong. This morning we're continuing in our series on Joseph, you know, the guy that we started talking about 4 weeks ago. We're going to pick back up and we're studying the life of Joseph. The last several chapters of Genesis deal with this man, a man who went through some of the most incredibly difficult circumstances, yet most of them are very similar to the ones that you and I share in. And God brought him through those with a lot of practical insight that we can apply to our lives today. You see, the same temptations that Joseph faced are the same temptations that happen today. And the Bible is so practical in that way because the truths apply even to today. So turn in your Bibles to Genesis chapter 39. Genesis chapter 39, we're going to look at the whole chapter this morning. The primary focus of Joseph's temptation was sexual in nature. That's a common temptation we face today. But don't just limit it to that. There are other areas where these principles will apply as well. Genesis chapter 39. The first thing that we see in Genesis 39 is Joseph's obvious success. Beginning with verse 1. Now Joseph had been taken down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an Egyptian officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the bodyguard, bought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him down there. Now, those of you who remember 4 weeks ago will be reminded of the fact that Joseph was the favored son in his family, destined to inherit the estate of his father, and because of the jealousy of his brothers toward him, they sold him into slavery. And there was a traveling group of Ishmaelites, modern-day Arabs, that were traveling to Egypt, and they sold him to them, and they carried him down to Egypt. When they got down there, put him on the auction block, and he was sold as a slave. But fortunately, God provided for him, and he was purchased by a very influential individual. This man, Potiphar, was the captain of the bodyguard. He was the captain of the palace security. He had charge over the prison, we'll see next week. He was a very important and influential man. Now, out of all the people that could have purchased this slave to go work in the fields or build pyramids or whatever was going on in Egypt at that time, Potiphar, this very influential man, purchases Joseph. And now we'll see his rise, starting in verse 2. And the Lord was with Joseph. That's the first step in anybody's rise. God was with him. Number 2, so he became a successful man. This man begins to achieve in the house of Potiphar through God's presence. And he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. Now his master saw that the Lord was with him and how the Lord caused all that he did to prosper in his hand. Step number 3, other people begin to recognize the obvious blessing of God in your life, if it's there. You know, it's amazing to me, the passage doesn't specifically say what it looked like, this success, or how this man knew, but here you have a pagan man looking at one of his slaves that he bought for money, not much more than an animal in those days, looking at this man and recognizing that his God is causing him to do well. Now, I don't know if he solved some problems in the administration of the household that were unique and nobody else was able to solve them, if he was able to work out interpersonal problems, if when he came on the ranch it finally started to rain and it hadn't rained in years. I don't know what it was. But whatever it was obvious to Potiphar that God was with him and blessing him. So, verse 4, Joseph found favor in his sight, and he became his personal servant. He went from the bunkhouse into the sleeping quarters in the house. He got moved in to be the personal assistant to Potiphar. And he made him overseer over his house, and all that he owned, he put in his charge. Now he's moved in, and we see the fourth principle here. When God's with you, God blesses you, other people see it, and you get put in charge. Now, when we see this passage, you may think put in charge of his household was probably talking about here is making sure the laundry gets done and the food gets cooked. That's not what's going on here. When he's put in charge of his household, that means he's put in charge of the family business. While Potiphar's off being the captain of the bodyguard, all of his property, all of his fields, all of his grain, all of his cattle, plus the family enterprises, he is the personal manager of the whole affairs of all this guy's household. A very, very influential position. Verse 5, and it came about from the time that he made him overseer over in his house and over all that he owned, the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house on account of Joseph. Thus the Lord's blessing was upon all that he owned in the house and in the field. So he left everything he owned in Joseph's charge, and with him there he did not concern himself with anything except the food which he ate. Final step in the progression. God begins to bless the Egyptian, the pagan, through putting Joseph in charge. So now the blessing is passed on. The blessing has gone on to the person who doesn't even believe in God because of the man, Joseph. Now, before we really dig deep in the section on temptation, I think we need to stop and make application of these first six verses, first of all. You see, Joseph had every reason in the world to be a bad employee, didn't he? Joseph had every reason in the world to be resentful. Hey, the guy was sold into slavery. He had no choice about this. His brothers had done him wrong. He had every possible reason in the world to slough off, to come into this guy's house and say, I'm here, I'm a slave, I can't do anything about it, I hate my brothers, I hate this man, I hate everything about this, I'm in a foreign land, I hate it here, and therefore I'm going to do the minimal. Just get by, just to keep from getting beat, just to keep from getting whipped. Just barely enough to get by. But Joseph doesn't do that, does he? He takes on exactly the opposite attitude. He works hard. He enjoys the blessing of God. He prospers. He succeeds. Pharaoh trusts him. He's faithful. What about you and I? You know, it's real easy when the boss at IBM or TI doesn't treat us the way we feel like we need to be treated, or our circumstances at work don't work out the way we want them to work out, or the company doesn't live up to the promises they made to us, for us to say, well, you know, I'm not going to give them an honest day if they're not going to give me an honest day's wage. I'm going to cut corners. I'm going to lengthen lunch hours. I'm going to live up just to the performance level that I have to get by. Because, after all, these people don't care about me, so why should I perform and work hard for them? All of you see that every day in different people, maybe even in yourself. Paul tells us in Colossians chapter 3, verse 23 and 24, talking to servants about their masters and their relationship to work, he says, whatever you do, do your work heartily, as for the Lord rather than men, knowing that from the Lord you will receive the reward of the inheritance. It is the Lord Christ whom you serve. Do you know that? Do you know the 8 or 9 hours a day that you put in for the company is not really ultimately for the company? It's ultimately for the Lord. And your boss is not ultimately the guy who sits in the big office down the hall. Your boss is ultimately God Himself, Jesus Christ. That's whom you live your life for. That's who you serve. Whether the guy down the hall is legitimate or whether he's a jerk doesn't matter. Your character, your honesty, your love for God and your service from Him, that's really the issue. You see, Joseph knew something, and that was that he didn't work for Potiphar. He worked for God, and God blessed him. Well, in verse 7, we get into the section on temptation, and we see Joseph's attempt at seduction. Verse 7, we see the first approach of Potiphar's wife, and it came about after these events that his master's wife looked with desire at Joseph, and she said, lie with me. Now, Egyptian women at that time were the most liberated women of their day, by far a lot less liberated than what we would consider liberation, but in the ancient world, they were very liberated. Potiphar's out captaining of the guard, whatever they do all day long. Joseph's there running the household. He's in charge of every person and every activity in the household. And because of his success, and because of one other thing, which we see at the last part of verse 6, now Joseph was handsome in form and appearance, That means he was good looking and well built. He was your run-of-the-mill hunk. She looks at him and says, I want this guy. Now, when she says, lie with me, she's not talking about taking a nap. She has sexual desire for Joseph. And we see that her first approach is the direct approach. She comes right at him head on. And she speaks to him directly and tells him exactly what her intentions are. Come sleep with me. Come make love to me. Now, when you think about it, Joseph had every reason in the world to do this. Didn't he? Here's the master's wife, the one who is his direct boss. Think of the kind of influence that he could wield if he had the favors of the wife of the house. Think of the influence now that he would have if he knew what her husband was thinking, the next move that her husband was going to make. And what a better way to get it, or is there a better way to get it than to get in bed with the wife of the boss, the wife of the master? Not only that, but think about his loneliness. Here's Joseph taken away from his family, sold into slavery, living in a land where he knows nobody. And the first good-looking, warm thing that comes his way happens to be none other than the head lady of the house. One of the obvious ones is the sex and the enjoyment of that. Why not? But something even more subtle to think about is, what if he doesn't? Couldn't she ruin him? Here's the boss's wife saying, come sleep with me, and if he says, no way, what could she say to her husband? Couldn't she sabotage everything about him? He had every reason in the world to follow through, but he doesn't. And we see his response in verse 8. As directly as she approaches him, he comes back just as directly in verse 8. But he refused and said to his master's wife, behold, with me here, my master does not concern himself with anything in the house, and he has put all that he owns in my charge. The first reason he gives for not being willing to sleep with his master's wife is, I am responsible for everything here, and therefore I must be responsible in my character. Now, that's exactly the opposite of what happens so often today. Joseph had risen in attractiveness because he rose from being a slave to being a very powerful man. How often do men fall into immorality, not when they're at the bottom, but when they're at the top? When they have the big office, when their careers are going well, when they've reached a position, a level, a maturity, a financial stability, a position where they're above the rules. You see, Joseph recognized that he, even in his place of authority, was not above the rules, but he was responsible to exemplify the rules. Men in authority and women in positions of high place ought to be the most responsible, ought to be the most concerned for their character, ought to be the most in touch with setting an example. Not the most abusive. But haven't we seen the opposite of that in our society? From our pastors to our politicians, to the men on Wall Street? Men in power do not have to live by the same rules that everybody else does. Joseph said, absolutely not. I am in power, so I will live by those rules. He gives a second reason in verse 9. There is no one greater in this house than I, and he, that is her husband, has withheld nothing from me except you, because you are his wife. I've been trusted. I'm put in a position of trust, and I cannot violate that trust. But the third reason, and most importantly, how then could I do this great evil and sin against God? You see, Joseph recognized that God had brought him to the place where he was. That his success, that his attractiveness, that his desirability was because of what God had done. And for him at that point in time to turn and reject God, to disobey God, would be the ultimate slap in the face. You see, God, you've brought me along in my life. You've given me eternal life through salvation. You've given me a family. You've given me children. You've blessed me. You've prospered me. And now I'm at a place where I don't need you anymore. I cut you off and dive into this relationship over here. No way. Joseph said, I cannot do that. I cannot turn my back on God. He recognized God's place in his life. And therefore, he turned her down. Well, she doesn't stop with the direct approach. She continues to be persistent. And in verse 10 it says, and it came about as she spoke to Joseph day after day that he did not listen to her to lie beside her or be with her. Her approach continued day after day. Every time she got a chance, she would slip an innuendo. She would confront him again. She would try to persuade him day after day. And she changed her tactic a little bit. You look at the last part of verse 10. He did not listen to her to lie beside her, or, now she's presented another option, or be with her. Let's just be together. If we can't have sex, let's just spend time together. Let's be with each other. You know, that's one of the most subtle but dangerous things that you and I can face. When a man and a woman feel a sexual attraction to each other, and we know it's an impure thing, we know it's something that we shouldn't do, particularly if you know that the other person has designs on you, ideas, plans for you, but is willing to stop a little bit short because of your strength to say, well, let's just be friends then. Okay? You know, we've got a lot in common. And we both know that we could never do this, that is, get involved sexually, but we meet each other's needs. God has placed us in each other's lives, hasn't He? He brought us together so that we could communicate and you understand me so much better than anybody else. What a great opportunity for us to just build this friendship. Students, how many dating relationships turn sour? Because you've decided, well, I cannot get too serious with this person, but we can go out together, we can be together, we can continue to develop this thing, even though I know he doesn't have pure motives or she doesn't have pure motives. They're willing to wait. They're willing to hold off. That's a very, very dangerous place to put yourself in. The third approach she takes is the forceful approach. And we see it in verse 11. Now it happened one day that he went into the house to do his work, and none of the men of the household was there inside, and she caught him by his garment, saying, lie with me. And he left his garment in her hand, and he fled and went outside. The final approach she takes is the forceful approach. She grabs him and says, we're going to do it. And what does Joseph say? He turns and he runs away, leaving his clothes with her. He just gets out of his robe and gets out of the house. And she's left holding the robe. Second time that a garment has cost him a very important position. First time was his coat of many colors. Remember that? Joseph in clothes. He has a very difficult time with his wardrobe. Now, to me, that seems kind of an unspiritual thing to do. To run away. I mean, a real man of God, he is. You mean he doesn't have the strength to stand up to this temptation? Why didn't he turn to her in his most spiritual voice and say, listen, woman, I am a man of God, and I cannot be tempted by you. Let go of my clothes. Because you see, the Spirit of God is guarding my heart right now. And it will prevent me from having any thoughts that could carry me in a negative direction. Doesn't that sound more spiritual? Huh? It may sound more spiritual, but it's not very practical. You see, God tells us that the way to get away from forceful temptation is to turn tail and run. Let me give you another example of this. Turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 10. 1 Corinthians chapter 10. 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 13, is one of our favorite verses for dealing with temptation. But sometimes we fail to look at the whole context of 1 Corinthians chapter 10, and we miss some very valid insight into dealing with temptation. What's going on in the context of 1 Corinthians chapter 10 is that the Corinthian people are trying to ask, how do we relate our present Christianity to our past lives and the culture around us? For you see, in the Corinthian culture, something that was part of their religious and cultural experience, they would go into pagan temples, and part of their worship was temple prostitution and eating meat sacrificed to idols. And they would do that in the temple in the presence of their, quote, deity, and that was part of their religious experience. Now you know why the ancient world was much more religious than we are today. They had a real festive time in their worship. Well, some people were asking the question, you know, since this is part of our culture, I mean, can you imagine living in America and not celebrating Christmas? Well, what happened when they had one of their cultural festivals? Well, what do we do? Do we go in? Do we participate? Do we stay out? Do we avoid this stuff? How do we deal with all that? And chapters 8, 9, and 10 of 1 Corinthians deal with that question. Now, in verse 12, Paul makes a very important statement. He says, "Therefore, let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall." It's about the time when you think that you can put yourself in a position to be tempted, when you think you've got enough personal strength to survive temptation, take heed, be careful, watch out. That's when you fall. And then verse 13, one of our favorite verses, "No temptation has overtaken you but such as is common to man. And God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able, but with the temptation will provide the way of escape also, that you may be able to endure it." Now, verse 13 tells us that God will open doors so that we can escape when we face temptation, right? Let's add verse 14. "Therefore, my beloved, flee from idolatry." There's our word again. Flee. Now let me try to put these verses in perspective for you. If you're walking along the road of life, as we all do, you're going to face temptations that are common to man. The word there could be translated human. None of us have faced anything but human, normal temptations. So I'm going along the road, 1 Corinthians 10:13, and I run into a human temptation. Boom, it hits me in the face. I'm being tempted. God is faithful, and He will not allow me to be tempted beyond what I'm able, but will provide a way of escape, right? So He opens the door over here, and what's my job? 1 Corinthians 14 says what? Flee. When you see that door open, what do? You evaluate the size and shape of it and say, well, now, is this the door or isn't it the door? No, you flee. You get out of there, okay? Suppose I flee. There's the temptation, and I've gotten away from it. What if I venture back to the temptation? 1 Corinthians 10:12 says, "Be careful, take heed. When you think that you stand, that's when you fall." And so many times in life, we come to a normal human temptation. God opens the door. We get away and then turn around and walk right back into that temptation time and time again. One person has said, "When you flee temptation, leave no forwarding address." And that is very true. 2 Timothy chapter 2, verse 22, Paul tells Timothy to flee youthful lusts. God knows that we do not have the strength in and of ourselves to resist temptation. So how do we deal with it when it forces itself on us? We turn tail and run as fast and as hard as we can. That's what Joseph did. Now, did that have positive results in the life of Joseph? Let's see. Turn back to Genesis 39. We'll see what happens now. Genesis 39, beginning with verse 13, when she saw that he had left his garment in her hand and had fled outside, she called to the men of her household and said to them, "See, he has brought in a Hebrew to make sport of us. He came into me to lie with me, and I screamed." First thing she does is gather up the witnesses. Gather up all the men of the household, the people that her husband would have to come and face day after day after day. That'd be hard to do, wouldn't it, guys? Face the men of your household who are looking at you in the face and saying, you know, somebody tried to rape your wife. What are you going to do about it? Not only that, but you see the vindictive nature of this woman as she says to them, "Look what this Hebrew slave has done to us." Did you notice that? He came in to mock us. No, he didn't have anything to do with the men of the house. It was she and he that were having the problems. But she turns it around to bring them into the offense. So they're all stirred up about it. Boy, we've got a problem here. Verse 16, "So she left his garment beside her until his master came home." And it's almost like she got the white chalk out and drew it on the garment right beside the bed. So when he walked in, here are all the men of the house, and she's there where she was, and here's the evidence, and boy, he is going to be convicted. And he is. Verse 17, "Then she spoke to him with these words, 'The Hebrew slave whom you brought in to us came in to make sport of me. And it happened as I raised my voice and screamed that he left his garment beside me and fled outside.'" Now she blames her husband. "You see, it's your fault. You brought the Hebrew slave in." You know, so many times, when affairs don't work out, when attractions don't go right, when boyfriend and girlfriend who've been involved in immorality break up, the vindictive and hateful nature comes out so great. Here's the woman who wanted to share her most intimate self with Joseph, trying as best she can to have him killed. Because the penalty for raping, especially your master's wife, was death. You just see the anger, the scorn, the hate simmering inside this person. The fatal attraction that happens so often in life. Men, the woman that says you're the most wonderful thing in the world, and if you would just come away and make her life wonderful, can sink her teeth so deep into you, you'll never recover. Women, the same thing. High school students, junior high students, you're playing with fire when you play with immorality. Well, what does the man of the house do? Verse 19, "Now it came about when his master heard the words of his wife, which she spoke to him, saying, 'This is what your slave did to me,' that his anger burned. So Joseph's master took him and put him into the jail, the place where the king's prisoners were confined, and he was there in the jail." Psalm 105, verses 17 and 18 describe a little bit of the pain that he experienced in the jail, but God is still with him. You see, he might be a failure to Potiphar, but he's a success with God. Verse 21, "But the Lord was with Joseph and extended kindness to him and gave him favor in the sight of the chief jailer. And the chief jailer committed to Joseph's charge all the prisoners who were in jail, so that whatever was done there, he was responsible for." You see the same thing happening over again. "And the chief jailer did not supervise anything under Joseph's charge because the Lord was with him. And whatever he did, the Lord made it to prosper." Now, next week we'll begin to see why he needed to go to this prison, why he needed to be with Potiphar instead of with some other Egyptian, why Potiphar probably believed some of his story, or else he would have had him executed. But suffice it to say, didn't have a great outcome, at least immediately, in the life of Joseph. And let me leave three applicational principles with you about dealing with temptation that I think are very, very important. The first principle that we learn from this passage is that resistance to temptation doesn't always find immediate reward. Resistance to temptation doesn't always find immediate reward. Now, what we want to see happen here is that Potiphar comes back and one of the servant girls was in another room and she heard what really happened and she tells Potiphar and he has his wife put in jail and Joseph becomes the head of the house, right? That's what we would like to see happen. You know, sometimes you're going to experience the same thing. You may break up with a boyfriend because of his sexual pressure and think that the neatest guy in the church will begin to date you the next week and find out you go for 6 months without getting a telephone call from anybody. You may tell your boss at work that I will not lie for you and I'm not going to falsify these figures and find yourself unemployed. Resisting temptation does not always bring immediate positive results. And if that's your motivation, you might as well give in to the temptation. And I think the other side of it is to realize that Joseph may have ended up in jail whether he would have slept with her or whether he wouldn't. After we see the kind of woman she was, after three or four times in the sack, she may have turned on him anyway. And then he would have had evidence. The second principle is take radical measures to resist temptation. Take radical measures to resist temptation. In Matthew chapter 5, Jesus says that if your eye offends you, do what? Pluck it out and throw it from you. If your hand offends you, cut it off. What's the implication? If you've got a lustful eye that's continually wandering, you need to take radical steps to stop it. If you've got a greedy hand that keeps reaching into the till, you need to take radical steps to prevent that from happening. Whatever it takes, fleeing, running, you need to do whatever it takes to keep yourself from falling into temptation. Let me give you a couple examples of something that might be radical. Say you've got a coworker that really is tempting you, and you know that the opportunity is there, and you're struggling with it, and you're losing the battle. Maybe it would be better to change jobs and preserve your family, your purity, your dignity. That's radical, you say. Yes. Temptation is devastating. The final principle is let those who think they stand today take heed lest they fall tomorrow. Let those who think they stand today take heed lest they fall tomorrow. You may be thinking to yourself, this could never happen to me. I could never do anything like this. You're wrong if you think that. You're wrong if you think that. You know, there have been men, pastors, who have more seminary degrees than I do, who've preached better sermons than I will ever preach, who've pastored larger churches than I will ever pastor, who've written more books and books on marriage and family and fatherhood and resisting temptation. I'm not talking about some of these quacks that you see on television. I'm talking about real godly men who have fallen into immorality. Who am I to stand up before you and say, it could never happen to me? It could. And it could happen to you. And maybe immorality is not the thing that's tempting you. Maybe it's a whole host of other things. But if you and I do not resist and run, we could fall into the same kinds of things. One pastor got so serious about this that he sat down and made out a list of the moral consequences that would happen if he were to get involved in immorality. He made a list of 23. And every time he starts to feel this way, he pulls it out and reads through it just to remind himself of what those are. And let me just give you a couple of them. One is grieving the Lord who redeemed me, dragging his sacred name into the mud, one day having to look at Jesus, the righteous judge, in the face and give an account of my actions, following in the footsteps of these people whose immorality forfeited their ministries and caused me to shudder. And then he lists all their names. Inflicting untold hurt on Nancy, my best friend and my loyal wife, losing Nancy's respect and trust, hurting my beloved daughters, Karina and Angie, destroying my example and credibility with my children, and nullifying both present and future efforts to teach them to obey God. Why listen to a man who has betrayed Mom and us? If my blindness should continue or my wife be unable to forgive, perhaps losing my wife and my children forever, causing shame to my family, losing self-respect, forming memories and backlashes that could plague future intimacy with my wife, bringing great pleasure to Satan, the enemy of God and all that is good, heaping judgment and endless difficulty on the person with whom I committed adultery, possible bearing the physical consequences of such diseases as gonorrhea, syphilis, herpes, and AIDS, perhaps affecting Nancy or, in case of AIDS, even causing her death, possibly causing pregnancy with the personal and financial implications, including a lifelong reminder of my sin, invoking shame and lifelong embarrassment upon myself. That's just a few. Maybe it'd do us all some good to sit down and list the consequences of moral failure, of giving into temptation. When faced with temptation, the way to beat it is to remember God and run like crazy. Remember God and run like crazy. Let's pray. Father in heaven, I pray for each person here. All of us at one point or another have succumbed to temptation and done things that are wrong. Possibly hurt and devastated people around us, caused pain in our own lives. Father, I just pray that you would be healing up those wounds today. There's no sin that you cannot forgive. There's nothing that's too great for you not to be able to cover it with your blood. Father, I also pray for those today who are contemplating at this very moment giving in to a temptation. I just pray that you would convict their hearts, that you'd give them the grace to flee away. Father, I pray that none of us would ever get too self-confident to think that we are above being tricked and deceived into doing something wrong. I pray that you would make us dependent on you, that we would trust in you, that we would give our hearts to you so that we would be pure before you. Father, you're such a good God, and I thank you for speaking so directly to us through your word, through the circumstances of others who have gone before. And I pray that our lives would be changed as we listen to the truths that you teach us through your word. We pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen.